I've been asked, are you preaching old sermons? That's like asking a music director if he's leading old music. Each time a conductor leads Beethoven's Ninth, the audience is different, the setting is different, and the director has his own distinctive style. Over the years, I suppose I've preached on Psalm 121 over 20 times at least. Each setting is different, each congregation is different, and each sermon is different. Yet, I will not ignore the work that I've done on Psalm 121 over the years. The melody of Psalm 121 remains the same. So, I will repeat that melody, the truths of the psalm as I understand it, over and over again. And yet, the setting is always different. The times are always different. And the preacher is always different because I change as the years go by. So the answer to the question is yes and no. There are times that are particularly difficult in our world, and this is one of those times, I think we would all agree. For we are all observing with both sadness and anxiety the events of our times, the sheer horror of Flight 17 being blown out of the sky, down to the mutual acts of violence that we've witnessed between Israel and Hamas, with more and more innocent people being killed as the perpetrators each refuse the ways of peace. And there's the less well-publicized suffering of the people in the Democratic Republic of the Congo, one of the bloodiest conflicts in all the world. These world events not only call for our concern and our prayers, but also make us yearn for the reality expressed in this psalm of 121. My help comes from the Lord who made heaven and earth. If all we had in this psalm was that one phrase, it would still be enough to take your breath away. The Lord who made heaven and earth. That, my friends, is macro theology. This is the cosmic God, the God beyond our comprehension, the God bigger than our little minds can take in. This is the big picture. It is that cosmic God who will not let your foot slip. Albert Einstein told a parable that went like this. A little child enters a huge library, and there are books all around, all the way up to the ceiling. And the books are in many different tongues. I'm quoting Einstein now. The child knows that someone must have written these books. It does not know who or how. It does not understand the languages in which they were written. The child notes a definite plan for the arrangement of the books, a mysterious order which it does not comprehend but only dimly suspects. That, said Einstein, is the attitude of the human mind, even the greatest and most cultured, toward God. We see a universe marvelously arranged, obeying certain laws, but we understand the laws only dimly. Our limited minds cannot grasp the mysterious force that sways the constellations. That's Einstein. Einstein believed in a cosmic God, but he was never able to bring himself to believe in a personal God. The kind of God who not only created the universe, but also cares about your foot slipping on the journey. And yet, when we look at Jesus, we see that, like most people in his day, he believed in a cosmic God. He believed in this macro theology. He believed in a God who created the universe. But when his disciples heard him pray, they were absolutely shocked because they discovered that he not only believed in this cosmic God, he believed in a God so personal, so intimate, so caring for him that he could call this God Abba, Papa. This majestic, cosmic understanding of God, coupled with this intimate, personal understanding of God, who, as Jesus said, numbers the hairs of our head, is a confirmation of the words that we see in this psalm: the maker of heaven and earth cares about your foot slipping on the journey. The one who dazzles us with the mystery of creation is also the one who comforts and protects us with an intimate fellowship. This psalm is looked upon by many as a sort of a summer psalm. And that comes probably because of a mistranslation in the King James Version, which translated the first sentence as a declarative sentence instead of a question. The translators put a period instead of a question mark. They said, "I will lift up mine eyes unto the hills, from whence cometh my help." Period. That was a mistranslation. And the current translations have it right. "I will lift up mine eyes unto the hills. From where does my help come?" But we think of it as a summer psalm because, you know, we drive up into the mountains and we pull off to a lookout point and we get out of the car and we look out over this gorgeous panorama of mountains and blue sky and some wispy clouds, and we think, "I will lift up mine eyes unto the hills, from whence cometh my help." And that's true. We think of this Creator God who is our help. But that's not what this psalm is about. The writer of this psalm is not inspired by the beauty of the mountains. He's frightened by the terror of the mountains. He had to take a journey to Jerusalem. And to get to Jerusalem, he had to go through the mountains. And he knew how frightening it was, because those hairpin curves and those rocks were great places for thieves to hide. He didn't want to get mugged. And so he lifts this plaintive cry: "I lift up mine eyes unto the hills, from where will my help come?" But there's more than just fear for his physical health. There's also a spiritual fear here, because we have to remember that in those days, competing religions were all around. And other religions claimed that their God resided in the mountains. So when he looked up into the mountains, he also wondered about those other gods, and doubts arose. What if those other gods are stronger than my God? What if those other gods are angry with me as I walk this journey through the mountains? So there was both a physical fear and a spiritual fear. This is a psalm that taps both our physical and our spiritual anxieties. In contemporary language, we could say, I lift up mine eyes unto my health. From where will my help come? Or we could say, I lift up mine eyes unto my doubts. From where will my help come? These are the contemporary questions raised by the psalm. And the answer is always the same. He who keeps you will not slumber. What if, as you travel through the mountain passes of your life, the God of addiction has you by the throat? The promise is sure. The God who keeps you will not slumber or sleep, but will work with you and for you to release you from that hold of addiction and will not give up on you, even if you give up on yourself. Or what if you struggle with your faith and are not sure what you believe? The promise is the same. The God who keeps you will not slumber nor sleep, but will still be there for you and with you as you struggle with your own doubts. The ancient world of this psalm writer was a scary and anxious world, much like ours is. Their anxiety came from what to us would be strange beliefs. There was, for example, widespread belief that the sun and the moon were gods of the day and the night. What if these gods were angry with you? Everyone had seen symptoms of what we would call sunstroke. They thought it was the sun god out to get you. And as far as the moon is concerned, who knows what the moon could do to you at night? To this fear, the psalm offers this promise: the sun shall not strike you by day, nor the moon by night. You don't have to understand your anxieties. You don't have to have a diagnosis for your anguish in order to trust this cosmic God who also cares about your foot slipping and will never leave you or forsake you. No wonder we love this psalm. It reaches down into parts of us that we rarely reveal to anyone else. Now, there's one more thing about this psalm I want to point out. Have you noticed that the writer of this psalm loves the word keep or keeper? The Lord is your keeper, he says. And if you look closely at this psalm, you'll see that the writer of this psalm uses the word keep 6 times in 6 verses. He was really enamored with that word keep. It's like he's trying to hammer it home. The Lord will keep you. You don't have to worry about this God getting tired of you or becoming fed up with you or giving up on you. The Lord will keep you. It's a promise. 6 times over, it's a promise. Now, you know what a keeper is. Some of you here remember bringing that boyfriend home to meet your parents. And when he left, your parents turned to you and said, "That's a keeper." And you knew exactly what they meant. A keeper is someone you're willing to commit to. Someone you're willing to spend your life with. A keeper has another meaning too. A keeper is someone who is charged with guarding or caring for something important, such as a lighthouse keeper, or a beekeeper, or a groundskeeper. This God we are talking about is our soul keeper. The Lord will keep your life, says this psalm. And the word translated life can also be translated soul. God is our soul keeper. And how long will this keeper keep on keeping? Will this keeper grow tired or retire? Will this keeper get frustrated with us? Will this keeper get distracted or wander off from us? This is no temporary keeper. The Lord will keep your going out and your coming in for how long? From this time forth and forevermore. No wonder we love this song. Out of the grandeur of this inspired vision of God comes the assurance of Psalm 121. We love it because it rings true, and it is reflected years later in the words of Jesus. Remember, he said, I am with you always, always. This everlasting presence of God is the fulfillment of this precious promise in Psalm 121. My help comes from the Lord who made heaven and earth.